Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. These are the words of General Dwight David Eisenhower. "The things I saw beggar description, the visual evidence and the verbal testimony of starvation, cruelty, and bestiality were so overpowering as to leave me a bit sick. I made the visit deliberately in order to be in a position to give firsthand evidence of these things if ever in the future there develops a tendency to change these allegations merely to propaganda. I'm Glenn Moberg. Upon witnessing the horrors of the Nazi concentration camps, slave labor camps, and extermination camps, General Eisenhower instructed all of his soldiers who had cameras to photograph and document the evidence so that the world would never forget and never doubt what had happened there. One of those soldiers was John Rainier of Stevens Point, who served in a medical battalion that supported General George S. Patton's Third Army. John Rainier kept his photographs, his diaries, and his memories to himself for almost 70 years. But at the age of 93, he says he can no longer be silent. His new book, Denying the Deniers, A Soldier's Intersection with the Holocaust, was written to rebut and condemn those who say the Nazi atrocities never happened. John Rainier is here for the next hour, and joining him is his friend and neighbor and fellow World War II veteran Will Lehner, who was at Pearl Harbor during the Japanese attack. They are both here to take your phone calls and comments at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or if you'd like, you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it on the air. Will and John, good to have you back with us again.
Thank you.
Very good to be here.
And can I ask you, gentlemen, how old you are? Will Lehner, we'll start with you.
Well, I'll be 93 in 2 weeks.
And John Rainier?
I'll be 93 in October, October 15th this year.
And there are fewer and fewer World War II veterans all the time. And you folks, those of you who are remaining with us, are like time capsules, shining a light on part of our history that we really shouldn't forget.
Well, we have lived quite a bit of history.
John, explain the title of your book, Denying the Deniers.
Well, I think the quotation you just read from General Eisenhower says it well. I really have tremendous respect for General Eisenhower. He recognized very early in the game that there would be deniers of the slave labor camps and the Holocaust situation that we uncovered after crossing the Rhine and getting deeper into Germany. We had the good fortune, I guess, and from a historical standpoint, to come through this little town of Ohrdruf, Germany, that we had never heard of before, of course, and Colonel was in the lead jeep of our battalion headquarters and took note of a gathering of GIs in a field right near the highway. And so he pulled off to see what this was. And lo and behold, we arrived just as General Eisenhower, Patton, and Bradley had arrived to go through the first slave labor camp that the 4th Armored Division had liberated. And our battalion was supporting the 4th Armored Division. That was the reason we were in that part of Germany at that time.
And you had no idea?
We had no idea. We hadn't really heard anything about slave labor camps. This was a pretty well hidden part of Germany at that time, and most of the camps were located east of the Rhine River. The Rhine River was the last barrier that they fought hard to keep the war from crossing that river. But
what was the first indication you had that there might be something terrible that had happened there?
Well, we initially, General Eisenhower had his Russian interpreter with him. There were this camp. We didn't learn the details until later. But they had, this was the first camp that the Third Army in fact, our division that we were supporting, 4th Army Division, came onto this camp right after the SS guards had slaughtered about 3,500 of the remaining people that were alive, and there were very few survivors. There were just less than 100 that were still physically in shape to sense what was happening and hid under buildings and out in the woods. But most of them had left the camp when we came on the scene. And Eisenhower apparently had arranged to be notified as soon as the first camp was liberated. They obviously knew more about some of these than we did.
And these 3,500 bodies, did you see them?
Yes, they were still, well, they attempted to dispose of these in mass graves. That was quite common in the slave labor camps, we learned, and they had dug two big mass graves that prior to the camp being overrun. But they just had these people come out of the barracks and machine gunned them, and then they had two mass graves quite filled, but there are still bodies scattered all over the grounds. When we started touring the camp, it was the most shocking thing we could ever imagine.
You write that the SS guards were ordered to burn as many of the bodies as possible before the Allies arrived.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, they set up. Of course, the regular gas ovens that they had in all of these camps, there were two big ones in this camp, and there was a body shed right next to the ovens. This was the first when we started the tour of the camp. My friend and I were standing about 12, 15 feet behind Eisenhower and Patton when the guard opened the door of the body shed. There was a stack of skin and bone bodies that normally would be burned in the gas ovens they had next to them, but they hadn't been able to dispose of all these. And I always remember Eisenhower's comment when they opened the body shed. He said, "This is the damnedest thing I've seen in all my life." And Patton's comment was, "The dirty German sons of bitches." I always remember we heard, those are the first comments we heard the two generals make.
Now you write, nothing would prepare us for what we would see, or even more significant, smell.
No, the odors were terrible. This was April 12th, 1945, a beautiful spring day, and of course these the grounds were full of corpses that the SS guards fled the camp before they were able to get these disposed of in the mass graves and the makeshift cremation pyres they set up. They had steel rails, appeared to be railroad rails, stacked on logs, and they would stack the bodies like cordwood on these rails and soak them in gasoline and torch them. And there were still quite remnants of partially burned bodies at those.
And you mentioned that quicklime covered the bodies, not to make them disintegrate, but to hold down the odors.
Yes, they'd sprinkle them with quicklime, especially the body sheds by the crematoriums. This just accelerated the odors. It added odors that you just couldn't imagine.
How old were you when you saw all of this?
I was 23 years old. We got to France right after Normandy was liberated. We joined the war in northern France, and the fighting was very heavy in the old World War One. The Germans were dug in the Maginot Fort area.
And then there was the Siegfried Line, too.
Siegfried Line on the German side and the Maginot Line on the French, and the Germans still controlled that part of France. And Third Army had the objective to clear them out of the northern France, and then we were to be the first army to invade German proper from France.
Now, you served in a field surgical unit, what would be called a MASH unit later, so you saw a lot of the horrors of war.
Yes, well, that our first assignment, our medical unit, we were not trained clinically, but when we got to, after Normandy, the war bogged down and there was tremendous fighting in the Metz-Verdun area, World War One area, and the Third Army had the objective to drive the Germans from there and take over that part of France. And so we were assigned as extra help in a MASH-type hospital right behind the front lines.
And the reason I bring this up now, John, you saw a lot of the horrors of war, but even that couldn't prepare you for what you saw in the concentration
camps.
That's right.
No, we were just assigned as extra help in this field hospital, and I was assigned to work in the surgery section, which turned out to be a tremendous experience to see the terrible refuge of war from the young Americans that were brought in.
Now, when you went to the concentration camp or the slave labor camp, as you say, at Ohrdruf, General Eisenhower had the foresight to ask you to take pictures.
Yes, before we left to go through the camp, when we were all collected just outside the camp, he had one of his staff people announce to the group, anyone had cameras was encouraged to take all the pictures you could because I want the world to know what we're seeing, was his comment. And my friend Fred Kercheval from Iowa, he had a camera that he kept in his duffel bag, and we shared using it. We hadn't taken many pictures in the war area. We took some when we were at the hospital, but this was the first opportunity we had to take some pictures in Germany itself. There were a lot of liberated cameras. After we got into Germany, we quit sleeping in our pup tents on the ground. We'd take over empty buildings. Most of the villages a lot of the civilians moved with the war to stay ahead of the war. And so there were a lot of empty buildings. And
how did you and Fred take those pictures?
Well,
did you talk while you were taking them?
Not too much. We learned more about the background of this several days after leaving Ohrdruf. We still had this roll of undeveloped film.
Let me read one of the captions in your book, because your photos are in this new book of yours, Denying the Deniers. Yeah. You say sharp focus is not needed to see the horror of this photo that we took of the starved naked bodies that were left in what became known as the body shed. And you write that it even made a tough guy like General Patton sick, physically ill.
Yeah, that's right. No, it was, that was the most shocking thing. You know, I'd seen an awful lot of war casualties at the hospital, but that was, these were all people that war tragically for the frontline infantrymen is kill or be killed, and we saw an awful lot of tremendously wounded Americans.
You know, there's one thing with civilians being killed as part of collateral damage, is the phrase we use now in the course of war. Yeah. But this was a systematic killing of innocent people.
Yes. It's been estimated that, well, we learned long after the war that Germany had 180 of these camps within German proper and approximately 200 in occupied countries, in the Balkans and Poland and Hungary and the places that they occupied.
And Eisenhower, in Ohrdruf, ordered the local civilians, including the mayor and his wife, to the camp to witness the atrocities that were taking place right under their noses.
Yeah, that was the commanding general of the 4th Armored Division, that the first one was there, and he had the MPs go in to round up the burgomaster, the mayor, and they brought him out and forced he and his wife to go through the camp with him. And he initially denied knowing about these, but there's no way you could believe that because the odor itself would would not mask the fact that what was going on.
What did it smell like?
Oh, just decaying bodies, you know. The big mass grave, they hadn't fully covered one of them.
How far away from the camp could you smell the odors?
Oh, you just, you had to get in the convoy and get on the road, get far away, because it was terribly, because all these decomposing bodies were just hard to comprehend the odor.
And how did the mayor and his wife react?
Well, they, after they had been forced to go through the camp the next morning, they were found, they both committed suicide. They hung themselves in the basement of their home.
Wow.
That was the, you know, they masked, we were told that most of the small villages, of course, where these camps are located, where they were farmers, during harvest season, if they needed extra help, because most young Germans were in the military, of course, so help was scarce. So we were told that a farmer could go to the camp and check out 8 or 10 people if he needed that many workers, and all he had to do was to account for them. If there were a couple of them died while
who were these people that were kept in the slave labor camps?
Well, they were. They had initially, the camps were built even before the war, with Hitler's objective to exterminate the Jews, and they were pretty much all Jewish occupied initially, and they were a relatively small number at that time. But as the war, after the war started, and Germany was bled down with their own manpower, of course they were in Africa, Italy, Balkans, and Europe, and so they had tremendous casualties in all those areas, and they kept.
They brought in more and more people. Poles, Russians.
Then they brought in Poles.
Gypsies.
Yeah.
And then you later went to Ebensee, is that how you pronounce it? Described as one of the most diabolical concentration camps ever built.
This was the, after going through order, of course, we couldn't comprehend, we didn't know too much about the scope of these camps, because that was pretty well masked. But we ended the war in Austria, and our former battalion commander, Colonel Sanford, had been promoted shortly after Ordriff and put in charge of a big field hospital. And right, we heard Eisenhower give orders to Patton and Bradley when we were in Ordriff. He said, as these camps are discovered, I want a infantry regiment and a medical unit assigned to the community, and I want the infantry, their duty is, their mission is going to be to round up all able-bodied civilians, men and women, to dig up mass graves, to clean out the barracks, to recover all the bodies that can be recovered.
And give them Christian burials.
And I want them given individual burials in simple pine coffins. And I want woodworking operations taken over by the Army to order them to make simple pine coffins for the, and they want the infantry is to round up the civilians and make them give individual burials. And we heard Eisenhower, he said, I want cemeteries built in or near these camps as a lasting monument to Nazism.
John Rainier, when you went to Ebensee, unlike Ordriff, there were still people alive in that camp.
Yes.
And you say you saw a man who looked like he was 70 years old, emaciated, hollow eyes, and he was a 30-year-old Jewish college professor.
38 years old, as I remember. That was the most. Colonel Sanford had, his hospital unit had been assigned to the last big camp that was liberated. That was Ebensee, Austria, in the foothills of the Alps. In this camp, there was still about 10,000 alive when it was taken over. And he got word back to his old unit, our unit, and we were north of Salzburg. We ended the war there in VE Day. and he contacted, this last camp was liberated 2 days before VE Day, and he contacted his old unit. He said, if you think we saw anything at Ordruf, come down and spend a day with me here, because this is even worse. And it was hard to comprehend that there could be anything worse than Ordruf. But
how long did these memories torture you after the end of the war?
Well, you never forgot them. Fortunately, I went to college after the war and got married and started raising a family and
worked for Century Insurance,
building a career. I started with Century Insurance in Minneapolis in 19.
And John, how do you react when you hear people deny that the Holocaust happened?
Well, that's most. I can really. I have evidence that I've collected that prove that that is totally untrue. You know, you just.
And that's why you wrote this book.
That's why I wrote this book, because it's. I think there's tragically. In fact, I heard. I have a niece that lives in Colorado. That after she got my book a few weeks ago and read it, and she was just amazed to get the background about the Holocaust, because she said that several years ago she had met a woman from Germany that was, I don't know if she was a tourist in this country or what, but this, my niece had some occasion to meet her and do quite a bit of visiting with her, and she said that she went out of her way to deny the Holocaust. She said that she had been in a Hitler youth school as a young girl in Germany. She had been educated by the SS troops that were the faculty in these Hitler youth schools. And she said that this slave labor camp business was all Jewish propaganda. This was
And you've got the proof that it wasn't.
And my niece, in reading my book, the story about it was the first detailed background that she had from my experience. And she was just so amazed to compare it to the story that she got from this German girl that had been in the Hitler youth schools and said that this was Jewish propaganda.
If you just joined us, we're talking to John Rainier, 93 years old, soon, of Stevens Point. He was a member of a medical battalion that supported General Patton's famous Third Army in the liberation of Europe. Holocaust witness, a witness to the horrors of the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. And he has written a new book called Denying the Deniers. And that's what he's doing today. He's denying those who denied that the Holocaust happened. We're going to come back and join John's friend, Will Lehner, who is not only another World War II veteran, but somebody who lives right next door to John. And Will will tell us about his experiences in Japan, not in Japan, but in Pearl Harbor, where he witnessed the Japanese attack December 1941. If you'd like to join the conversation and talk to these amazing two gentlemen, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
When the Second World War came to an end, we forgave the Germans. Then we were friends. Though they killed 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now too have God on their side.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Greenwood Hills Country Club, Wausau, helping the community one round at a time with Make a Difference Mondays, a day open for all golfers to enjoy a round of golf while benefiting a Wausau area charity. Details at greenwoodhillscc.com.
We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with John Rainier of Stevens Point, who served in General Patton's Third Army and who also was a witness to the Holocaust, to the concentration camps of Nazi Germany, as that army helped liberate Europe. His new book is called Denying the Deniers, and he is with us today with his friend Will Lehner, who also served in World War II and who also lives in central Wisconsin. Will, what do you think of your friend John Rainier's new book?
Well, I haven't read it yet, but I've talked with John for years about different things, and we've been on radio different times. And I'm learning more today listening to him. But I'm hoping that I can get his book and read the whole thing again.
And Will, there are fewer and fewer of you World War II veterans all the time. Why is your story, your experiences in that great war, so important for everyone to remember?
Well, one thing is I've asked different people who fired the first shot at Pearl Harbor. And they said, well, Japanese, naturally. They attacked us. And I said, well, you're wrong. I said, I was on the USS Ward, and we fired the first shot an hour and 20 minutes before the Japs came.
I've heard this story before, but for those who haven't heard it, tell us where you were when that happened and what you saw.
Well, I was attached to the USS Ward, which was a World War I destroyer, four-stacker. And our job at Pearl Harbor was to patrol the entrance to Pearl Harbor. And we took that assignment once a week on Saturday. We'd go back and forth between Barbers Point and Honolulu Harbor, patrolling that entrance to Pearl Harbor.
And you saw a submarine.
And it so happened that December 6th, we went out on our patrol, which was Saturday morning. And we had a new skipper aboard that just came aboard the 5th of December, W.W. Outerbridge, a young lieutenant, first command he ever had. And he was our new skipper. Well, we didn't know anything about him. He came aboard on a Friday. Saturday, he took command of the ship, and we went out there. And 3:30 in the morning, he called general quarters. And we thought, Sunday morning, 3:30, why is he calling general quarters? Well, we got to figuring that we didn't see anything, nothing happened. So this guy must be just seeing what we can do, you know, training his new recruits. And we went to general quarters at 3:30, and probably about 4:30, 5 o'clock, they secured from general quarters. Nothing happened. We went back to bed. Those that were in our bunks went back to our bunks, and about 6 o'clock, we got general quarters again. And we thought, boy, this guy is going to be a tough skipper to get along with, because calling general quarters just for drills.
But you saw a submarine.
Well, not at the first one, we didn't. But
the point, Will, is that you were witness to this attack before
right.
It happened.
That's right. And about 6:30, then we saw a periscope that was trying to get in the harbor following a supply ship, the Antares, that was just coming back. And we saw the periscope, and it wasn't long in that conning tower came up. They must have had problems staying down, and the whole conning tower was up. Well, the skipper was on the bridge, and he says he had we were at general quarters, and he had all guns ready to go. So they fired number one gun, and I saw my job was after ammunition handler, so I had nothing to do until the time that they needed more ammunition. So I saw the first shot, and it went right over the top of that conning tower.
And this was how many hours before the actual Japanese attack?
An hour and 20 minutes.
Why wasn't anybody warned?
Well, they were warned, because when we finally hit the sub with number three gun, we were only 50 to 100 yards away. And the second one hit it right in the conning tower, right above the water line. And I saw it when it hit. I saw it when it rolled over. I saw it when it rolled back. Then it started to sink.
And many people, Will Lehner, doubted your story, but it has been verified.
Finally, after 62 years. But
tell me how they verified it.
Well, in 2000, National Geographic sent me over with Bob Ballard, who found the Titanic. And he wanted to find the Titanic, or he wanted to find the sub that we had sunk.
And did they find it?
No, we had 72 markings, and we looked for 14 days. And, of course, at the end of 14 days, the money ran out, and National Geographic says just
how did they verify it, Will?
Well, 2 years later, the University of Hawaii was doing underwater searches, and they had been looking for it for 20 years. And they found it, and Terry Kirby called me from Hawaii. He called me in Stevens Point, and he said, "Will, how would you like to come over and go down in a submersible with me? I found that sub that you guys sunk."
So your story was verified, and had the word gotten to the right people and had they listened to it, maybe we would have been a little bit more prepared with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
I don't know if that would have helped. The skipper, after we fired the shot and saw that the submarine was going down, he sent a message, "We have fired upon and sunk an unidentified submarine in restricted waters." Well, that's as far as it went.
So, and then later that day, you witnessed the carnage at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, well, then about 5 minutes to 8 o'clock, that's when the planes came over. And that was 6:45 when we sunk the submarine. So,
if you just joined us, we're talking to Will Lehner, a World War II veteran who was at Pearl Harbor on the day of the infamous attack in 1941, and John Rainier, who was with General Patton's 3rd Army as it liberated Europe, and a witness to the Holocaust, the liberation of the concentration camps. John Rainier, you and Will Lehner have had a lot of stories to talk about over the years.
Yeah, well, for years we just talked about our respective yard work and so forth. We didn't talk about war.
A lot of you World War II veterans never talked about war. My father served as a radio operator behind enemy lines in Europe, and he never talked about it.
Yeah. Well, it seems that we survived the Depression era before going into the Army in World War II, and we had an awful lot of contemporary objectives, and you just didn't bother to do much reminiscing. But
some of those memories were hard to recall.
Oh yes, and many of the detailed memories are very easy to recall because they were stored in the stored in the bank, and came back real fast when we.
But they weren't something you wanted to think about.
I think this all started reminiscing about the war and talking about it with the 50th anniversary of D-Day, when Stephen Ambrose wrote his book and
And that was 1994.
The Stephen Ambrose wrote a book, and Studs Terkel wrote a book, and there are many books written about World War II, and this kind of uncorked the bottle of, I had retired in 1984, and I was interviewed by the local paper as a World War II veteran, and some of my story, and this kind of unleashed an awful lot of invitations to talk to schools and so forth,
and you have unleashed more memories with this newly published book, "Denying the Deniers: A Soldier's Intersection with the Holocaust." 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to talk to John Rainier and Will Lehner, let's go to Dave, who is on the road and who has been waiting patiently. Dave, you're on Route 51.
Hey, thanks, Glenn, for having me on, and thank you, all three of you, for your courage and putting this program on. It's wonderful. And thank you, Will and John, for your service. A salute. And my comment, and I'm just going to make a comment, is specifically aimed at John. John, my three children are grandchildren of a survivor, and he lost his mother and father and four brothers at Auschwitz. I just want to tell you that from the bottom of my heart, there is no more important work to be done in this world than that you are doing right now. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
Thank you very much. I agree with you that this is very important, too. Important part of history.
Dave, thanks so much for the phone call. Let's go to Claire in Baraboo. Claire, you're on Route 51 with John Rainier and Will Lehner. Hello, Claire.
Good morning, Glenn, and what an important program, as your previous caller said. I am so moved by these stories of these two gentlemen, and I'm so glad. It has to be so painful for them to relive this over and over again, but I am so glad that they are still with us to tell these stories, because we need to know the truth. And for anyone to deny the Holocaust is just shocking to me. But for both of the gentlemen to have lived through what they went through and to come out normal, I don't know how they lived beyond those experiences as well as they did, and I'm so grateful to them and the story. I guess I'm just so moved. I'm not quite sure what else I want to say, Glenn.
Claire, I think you said it all. Thank you so much for the phone call. John Rainier, your reaction?
Well, I really appreciate the attention that this is drawing to many people that haven't had an opportunity to get firsthand information such as this. But I have felt almost an obligation to share my memories with people who are interested, because I think it is tremendously important. I always think of former President Truman's infamous comment, "The only new in history is the old history we do not know." And it's, I think we keep repeating history.
Will Lehner, when you were at Pearl Harbor and you saw that attack, describe that for me. What you saw in the water.
I don't think you can really describe it. You have to see it. As John would say, you can't really describe the autocracies. We saw men floating in the water at Pearl, burnt. The oil was burning in the water, and the men jumped in the water from the ships, and they were covered with burning oil, and it's hard to explain that.
How do you react, and I'd like both of you gentlemen to react to this. General Sherman, back in the Civil War, said, "War is hell." And the United States has been criticized for the firebombing of Dresden, which killed hundreds of people, and for the atom bombs that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why is that somehow qualitatively different than what the Nazis did in the concentration camps and what the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor?
Well, war is a very cruel, inhuman way of trying to solve problems. And it's a, I don't think, I feel strongly that there's never been a good war, but probably the two most necessary wars that we have participated in was the Civil War, which saved our country, kept it whole, and World War II. I think World War II came to be a necessary war in that Hitler had conquered most of Europe, and by the time we got in, and Japan was well on the way to controlling all of Asia. So if the two military dictatorships that each of those countries had prevailed, and we hadn't gone in the war when we did after Pearl Harbor, I think that we would be living in a different world today.
That's true. That's true. Well said, John.
Will Lehner and John Rainier, both veterans of World War II. Will was at Pearl Harbor the day it was bombed, and John Rainier helped liberate the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. His new book is called Denying the Deniers. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on our Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it on the air. I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
Until the philosopher, which owed one race a theory and another inferior, is finally and permanently discredited.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Stevens Point Area Co-op, Peninsula Music Festival, and Import Auto Clinic. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from The Hostel Shop in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, committed to helping people rediscover the joy of cycling with recumbent trikes and a comfortable, efficient, and easy riding experience. More at hostelshop.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrick. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Will Lehner, who was a witness to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and John Rainier, author of Denying the Deniers, A Soldier's Intersection with the Holocaust. And that book has just been published. And John, you tell a story in the book that you've told me before, but I'd like you to share it with me, because it talks about the prejudice, the stereotypes, the nationality, the jingoism, the racism that seems to underlie so much of the conflicts human beings have had, about an SS officer that was brought into the field hospital that you were working at.
Yes, that was it. I had never heard the term SS when this happened. As I mentioned earlier, our first assignment when we got to we joined the war in northern France, and casualties were extremely high on both sides, and I was our unit was assigned as extra help in this field hospital. Well, when we worked 12-hour shifts 7 days a week, and that they were doing from 125 to 175 surgeries every 24 hours in those tents out in the field in France. And the night that Third Army finally took over the old Maginot Line fort area, that was the last barrier that Germany had to prevent the war from getting into Germany. And I was working nights, and they got into the forts, and the Americans got in there. They found an awful lot of wounded Germans that had no medical care since they were injured. And they they became prisoners of war, of course. So I was working nights when a convoy of our ambulances came in with this first group of badly wounded Germans from the forts in Maginot Fort, the fort area. And I happened to be in one of the, there were four tables in each of two tents. There were eight tables, operating tables working full time. And there was a young German, I happened to be in one of the surgery sections when a young German was brought in, a 22-year-old SS officer. I'd never heard the term before. But these were the people that were the fanatically trained people in the German Nazi system.
And they had to be Aryan, pure Aryan.
Yeah, correct? They had to be pure Aryan to be SS troops. And he had his right arm blown off at the shoulder. An artillery shell had hit near him or something. And he had a badly infected wound and missing arm, and he was still very ashen. And the surgeon, he was brought in, put on one of the tables. This was about 1:30 in the morning. And the surgeon, there had been notes. He did some vital signs reading in the prep room before surgery, and the surgeon took a look at the chart for him, and he said, if we have any chance of saving this guy, he's going to need whole blood and need it fast. And whole blood was used in only the near-death cases. And he, this man feebly, he was still conscious, spoke a little English. He feebly raised his left arm and said, what kind of blood is it going to be? The surgeon said, well, it'll be the right type of blood. What's the problem? He said, well, if it's Jew or Negro blood, I don't want it. And the surgeon, I really respected him. He pulled the blanket over him. He said, take this man off the table. There's men waiting that want to live more than he does. And I'm sure that guy died that night. But that these people were fanatically trained in that way. It's just hard to comprehend that that statement he heard.
And that's extreme, but when you served in World War II, our army was segregated.
Oh, yeah.
And you dealt with racial prejudice when you had to train in the South.
Oh, you bet. Oh, Mike, going to Mississippi from Minnesota was a shock to me.
Will Lehner, the Navy was segregated, too, on December 7th, 1941, when that attack took place at Pearl Harbor.
Well, I don't know if it was. We had Negroes on the ship, mess attendants for the officers, and I got along good with them. You know, I always did. I've got good friends that are Negroes.
You would hope that we would have gotten past some of this.
Yeah. There was in Mississippi. That was a shock to me, born and raised in Minnesota, of course. I thought Civil War had liberated the blacks, but Mississippi and...
What will it take for us to get past the racial prejudice that seems and the nationalism that seems to underlie so many wars? What will it take for all people and all nations to live in peace? War and the atrocities of war have been with us since the beginning of human history.
Yeah. Yeah. Tragically, it's bred by selfishness and greed of rulers that have immunized themselves from personal danger and are overly willing to risk the lives of people to get their way. That's a terrible system.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And hopefully, John Rainier, at the advanced age of 92, people will finally see your story in this new book of yours, Denying the Deniers, A Soldier's Intersection with the Holocaust. Will Lehner, are you ever going to write your memoirs?
Well, I've got them here. Got them all in my head. Everyone tells me you got to start now. And I says, well, I got a lot of other things to do.
We want to thank today's guests, John Rainier, author of Denying the Deniers, A Soldier's Intersection with the Holocaust, published by the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics in Leadership at Viterbo University, La Crosse, Wisconsin. Also thanks to Will Lehner, World War II veteran and witness to the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Bob Dylan, Bob Marley, John Williams, and Itzhak Perlman from the movie Schindler's List, and Jerry Goldsmith with the theme from the movie Patton. Next Thursday on Route 51, we continue our look at World War II history with a special Independence Day weekend encore presentation of our interview with Chester Nez, last of the Navajo Code Talkers, who passed away this month at the age of 93. Remember to follow us on Facebook. If you missed part of the show, you can hear it again in its entirety Friday night at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.